I guess I misremembered the title that Ed had asked me to speak on, but that's okay because this is another talk anyway that I just put that title on. So we'll see how it all works out. I was raised in a very conservative, committed Christian home, and I accepted that training early on with a great deal of enthusiasm. But I also fell deeply in love with the natural sciences quite early on, even before I reached my teens. But I began encountering claims that historically there had been a conflict, even a warfare, between science and religion, that science had shown religious belief to be no longer rationally defensible, and in fact the birth of science had basically marked the death of religion. One very colorful statement of that came from Thomas Huxley, known as Darwin's Bulldog, who said, "Extinguished theologians lie about the cradle of every new science as the strangled snakes beside the cradle of Hercules." It's not an encouraging beginning. But this picture of tension warfare created some problems for me. Some people said that science and religion really couldn't conflict because they operated in different domains on different levels, and that there was, in effect, a wall of separation between the two of them. But I never really liked that view, and I still, in fact, don't. Walls, after all, are tricky sorts of things. Think of a medieval wall city under siege. The wall might keep the attackers out for a while, but eventually the people inside that are being protected by that wall are going to starve. And if science and religion operate on separate domains with a wall around religion, what often happens is that science becomes a domain of objectivity and reason and rationality and fact in the real world, and religion comes to be seen as a domain of subjective feelings, emotion, and mere faith. Religion drifts into kind of an optional irrelevance to the real world. And under those circumstances, religion might be safe from attack, but it seems to me that it risks starvation. And who wants to commit their life to a religion whose survival depends upon its being protected behind a wall? Especially as an adolescent male, I wanted a vastly more rough and tumble and snarky religion than one that needed any kind of protection. Perhaps surprisingly, this perception of tension and conflict with religion being at risk, that isn't just a modern invention. You can find that already in the 17th century. The chemist Robert Boyle reported there are several divines, church officials, and some of them eminent ones that out of a holy jealousy, as they think, for religion, labor to determine from addicting themselves to serious and thorough inquiries into nature as from a study unsafe for a Christian and likely to end in atheism. And this sentiment shows up in some rather startling places. John Wesley, of all people, in a sermon titled The Use of Money, said, "I am convinced from many experiments I could not study to any degree of perfection either mathematics, arithmetic, or algebra without being a deist, if not an atheist." Now, at Calvin College, where I teach, we do not allow students to know about this quote because quite a number of them would try to get out of their math graduation requirement on theological grounds if they thought they could cite Wesley. But what I want to do with you here this afternoon is just to stare some of these alleged challenges in the eyeball, see what sorts of challenges there are, look at a few of the major categories of challenges, see how powerful they are, what perhaps could be or should be said in response to some of those. So that's where we're going to begin here. It's sometimes said that the core philosophical foundations of science and religion are inherently irreconcilable. The picture here is that if you burrow down to the heart of science and burrow down to the heart of religion, you will find philosophical foundations that just can't be fitted together. A very nice statement of this comes from Norman and Lucia Hall in a recent article, who said, "Science and religion are diametrically opposed at their deepest philosophical levels. There is a fundamental incompatibility between the supernaturalism of traditional religion and the experimental method of science." Well, first, just a little cautionary note. Historically, the birth and development of modern science involved almost exclusively theists and largely Christian theists. And they apparently had somehow missed this fundamental incompatibility between their religious belief and what they were beginning to do in science. If the Halls are right, these people just couldn't see things very clearly and didn't really understand the science that they were in the process of developing. But to classify people like Copernicus and Galileo and Newton and Kepler and Boyle and Herschel and Whewell and Faraday and Maxwell as not being very perceptive, that strikes me as a little bit implausible. But suppose there were deep philosophical differences. What are the sources of those differences? Well, the answer to that question comes from the Harvard biologist Richard Lewontin, who said, "Our willingness to accept scientific claims that are against common sense is the key to an understanding of the real struggle between science and the supernatural. We take the side of science because we have a prior commitment, a commitment to materialism. It's not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenal world, but on the contrary, that we are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. Moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door." Now, Lewontin here is saying that science is constructed out of an a priori philosophical anti-supernatural commitment. And he admits that this materialism, this anti-supernaturalism, which he says constitutes the real scientific challenge to religion, he admits that that doesn't arise out of science, that that's not a result of science, but he says that that's something that is deliberately built into science on the basis of philosophical prior commitments. Now, of course, if this conflict between science and religion represents just warring prior philosophical commitments of various people, its significance begins to evaporate. I mean, why should we buy his philosophical preferences? I mean, why should we care about his philosophical preferences? And if that's all the conflict is at bottom, then it loses quite a bit of its significance. But the issue goes even deeper here. And for the next few minutes, I'm going to have to talk like a philosopher. And I don't apologize for that. I didn't conceal the fact I was a philosopher when I came here, but that is just sort of truth in advertising. Suppose, on the basis of science, somebody raised an objection to the rational legitimacy of your religious belief. Well, if the objection doesn't rest on a rationally justified basis, who really cares? I mean, if somebody raises a problem for your religious belief based on something they read in the National Enquirer or the Weekly World News, you don't really have a problem, right? So, simple principle. Science-based challenges to religious belief are not significant unless science itself is rationally justified. Perfectly obvious. But science itself rests on a variety of presuppositions, as we all know. Things like the uniformity of nature, the appropriateness of human concepts to understanding reality, the basic reliability of human sensory faculties, the ultimate intelligibility of nature, and a bunch more. Now, obviously, the rational legitimacy of science depends upon the rational legitimacy of those presuppositions. Science can only be as good, it can only be as secure as its own foundations. So, science is not rationally justified unless the foundational presuppositions upon which it rests are rationally justified. Now, here's the key point. Since those presuppositions are, as their name implies, presupposed in the very doing of science itself, science cannot provide the rational justification for those presuppositions. Those presuppositions have to be in place and available to science before science can really get moving. So, science can't be the source of the rational justification for its own foundational presuppositions. So, if science is rationally justified, then its presuppositions must be justified, but science can't provide that justification itself. So that justification for those presuppositions must come from elsewhere. So since they have to come from elsewhere, if science itself is rationally justified, then science itself cannot be the only basis of rational justification. It seems to follow straightforwardly. And, consequently, if science-based objections to religious belief are rationally legitimate, then there must be some deeper source of rational justification than science itself. Now, that immediately raises the question, what other source of rational justification might there be for these foundational principles on which science itself depends? Well, historically, Christian theological principles, most specifically the doctrine of creation and what was known as the doctrine of divine voluntarism, provided that kind of rational justification in the eyes of early scientists. Let me give you just a couple examples of how that worked. Here are a battery of presuppositions of science. This is not an exhaustive list at all, just kind of informal. Now, early scientists, when they were hammering out the very basis of science, what science was and what it was going to be, connected each of these explicitly to their theology. So, for instance, nature is intelligible. It's understandable. There's no point in doing science if you don't think it's possible to understand at least something about nature. Why should we think that nature was intelligible? Well, the answer that early scientists gave was that the creation was the creation of a rational being, God, who created with wisdom. So wisdom was built into the creation, and that made it intelligible. The second one on the list, science must be empirical. Why would science have to be empirical? Well, because God created freely, as they saw it. There weren't any rules that were binding God, that were forcing God to create in a particular way. So if we wanted to know what God had done, we had to look. And you can find all of these points made explicitly in the preface of Newton's first major work, the Principia Mathematica, written by his friend Roger Coates. And Coates says this: without all doubt, this world, so diversified with that variety of forms and motions we find in it, could arise from nothing but the perfect free will of God directing and presiding over all. From this fountain it is that those laws, which we call laws of nature, have flowed, in which there appear many traces of the most wise contrivance, so there's the intelligibility, but not the least shadow of necessity. God wasn't forced, he was free. These therefore, notice the therefore, this is an inference from theology. These therefore we must not seek from uncertain conjectures, but learn them from observation and experiment. There it is in the preface of Newton's Principia. Other things that early scientists connected up to their theology in the same way. The wisdom that was built into the creation and which made it intelligible was, of course, divine wisdom. Why should we think that we humans had any chance of understanding that? Well, Kepler said, in publishing the Mysterium Cosmographicum, which was his first major work, the effect which I strove to obtain was that the belief in the creation of the world be fortified through the external support that thought of the Creator be recognized in its nature. Then man will at least measure the power of his mind on the true scale and will realize that God, who founded everything in the world according to the norm of quantity, also has endowed man with a mind which can comprehend those norms. And if you look deeper into this issue, what you find is that people were holding the view that the minds with which we try to understand the creation were made in the image of, they mirrored, to some extent, the mind whose wisdom was built into the creation. So there was going to be at least a provisional match there which could undergird our attempts to understand. So even though it was supernatural wisdom, we humans had a shot at understanding the intelligibility of the cosmos. Another presupposition on the list, the uniformity of nature, something that all of you have grown up with. Why should we think that nature is uniform? Well, look on the right there, Robert Holcott. God rules nature with an unfailing conditional necessity appropriate to God because of his promise, that is, his covenant or established law. So here we find law and its uniformity linked directly to God's faithfulness, his covenant. Why should we think that natural laws not only are uniform, but that they are universal, that they apply everywhere? Well, Isaac Newton gives us the answer to that question. If there be an universal life and all space be the sensorium of a thinking being, God, who by immediate presence perceives all things in it, then the laws of motion arising from life or will may be of universal extent. What Newton is saying here is that God is omnipresent. God runs the cosmos. God is consistent, so God will run the cosmos in which he is omnipresent in exactly the same way everywhere. So we can be confident that the laws that apply here and now in our labs will also apply in distant galaxies in the past and will apply in the future, that they are universal for all time and space. So when you see some things like this, and again, this list could go on and on, you start to understand why Pierre Duhem said something that initially sounds really astonishing. Scientist and philosopher, he said, if we had to assign a date for the birth of modern science, we should undoubtedly choose the year 1277, when the Bishop of Paris solemnly proclaimed that there could exist many worlds and that the ensemble of celestial spheres could without contradiction be moved in a straight line. What in the world is he talking about? And how is this tied up with other things? Well, the reigning academic view, at least in some circles, in 1277, was Aristotelian, and Aristotle said that if you get down to the ground level principles of reality and of the cosmos, they are necessities. Well, that of course hampered trying to understand the cosmos, and especially the need to understand the cosmos in its fundamental structure, ultimately empirically. And so the Bishop of Paris, Etienne Tempier, said, look, that's not the way it is. God was free, divine voluntarism, to create as he wanted, and Aristotle notwithstanding, God can do exactly what he wanted. So there was a list here in 1277, a condemnation of 219 theses that the bishop said you could not accept and be in good standing with the church. They were fairly wide-ranging. One of them was the principle that the only wise people are philosophers. I've never had any trouble with that myself, but he didn't like it. But the main thrust was you cannot limit God. God was free. And consequently, ultimately, when it comes down to Roger Coates, that means that if we want to understand, we have to look. Science has to be empirically. So Duhem says 1277 was the initial spark. Now, this is kind of peculiar when you think about it, because this means that a church document issued by a Christian bishop on a disputed point of theological doctrine was the initial spark that set off what ultimately led to the scientific revolution. Science can only work in a certain sort of reality. And the picture that we get here of a comprehensible, an intelligible, a uniform, a predictable, even a beautiful cosmos, which can in principle make sense to finite minds like ours, that's a picture of a cosmos that's structured in some fundamental ways very like a mind would do it. That's a structure of a cosmos. That's a picture of a cosmos structured like a creation. And that's why the well-known contemporary physicist, he's an Australian physicist, Paul Davies, who is not a Christian, not a traditional believer in any sense, in one of his books recently said, science began as an outgrowth of theology, and all scientists, whether atheists or theists, accept an essentially theological worldview. So if science creates difficulty for religious belief, the foundational philosophical structure of science, which may owe its very existence and character to theology, that doesn't look like a very promising place to look. So it looks like Norman and Lucia Hall just plain got it wrong. The second general category of alleged conflicts involves not presuppositions and philosophical foundations, but results of science. There are, I think, three broad categories, subcategories of challenges here. They overlap to some extent. But let me just briefly introduce you to each of the three subcategories, and then we'll look in a little bit more detail at each one of those. The first is that scientific advances, scientific results, have rendered religion just irrelevant. Here's an analogy. If you go back a couple centuries, maybe not quite that far, you would find scientists talking a great deal about a substance called phlogiston. It played a role in theories of combustion, and you can find descriptions of this substance and its characteristics and how it operated and so forth. We no longer, of course, believe in phlogiston. But not because there was some experiment at some point that showed there was no phlogiston anywhere in the cosmos. Rather, what happened was that phlogiston theory was simply superseded. We have a better way of explaining combustion now, which does a good job. And we no longer need that idea. There just is no longer any work for the concept of phlogiston to do, so we can drop it without losing anything of significance. Now, some people have said that science has done exactly that same thing to religion. For instance, Stephen Hawking, in Brief History of Time, said the quantum theory of gravity has opened up a new possibility in which there would be no boundary to space-time. The universe would be completely self-contained. But if the universe is really completely self-contained, having no boundary or edge, it would have neither beginning nor end. It would simply be. What place, then, for a creator? We just don't need that concept anymore, in effect, says Hawking. The second subcategory here is that there's been sort of a bit-by-bit erosion of the secondary elements of the picture of reality that traditional Western religion presents. Science, on this view, has been progressively undermining or eroding or nibbling away things around the edge around the periphery of the religious worldview. If you go back a ways, you'll find religious believers, especially Christians, who thought that the earth was unmoving. That's gone. That the earth was the center of the cosmos. That's gone. That the earth was quite young. Most people have given that up. That there was a universal flood. A lot of people, including many Christians, have given that up as well. And there are some other things that have sort of fallen by the wayside here, too. Now, individually, none of these things were really essential to religious or Christian belief. You could quite easily be a Christian and not believe that the earth did not move. But this objection goes, taken together over the long haul, what we find here is a track record of the serial failure of religious belief. And that failure and that string of failures has been so consistent, so persistent, so substantive that you have to give up the idea that religious believers ever had any real grip on reality. A particularly nice expression of that sentiment comes from the 20th century British philosopher-mathematician Alfred North Whitehead, who said, "For over two centuries, religion has been on the defensive and on a weak defensive. The period has been one of unprecedented intellectual progress. In this way, a series of novel situations have been produced for thought. Each such occasion has found the religious thinkers unprepared. Something which has been proclaimed to be theologically vital has finally, after struggle, distress, and anathema, been modified and otherwise interpreted. The result of the continuous repetition of this undignified retreat during many generations has at last almost entirely destroyed the intellectual authority of religious thinkers." And then the last subcategory is a bit more drastic. It's the claim that the picture that scientific results constitute directly contradict not just stuff around the edge, not just presuppositions, but directly contradict the core elements of the religious picture. For instance, Richard Dawkins, that most of you have heard of. "In a universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference." Well, if that is the way the universe is like, then religious belief is basically out of business. Or perhaps a bit more eloquently, Bertrand Russell, the influential 20th century philosopher and everything else as well. Let me just read you a few sentences, and you'll see him saying these things. "Purposeless and void of meaning is the world which science presents for our belief. That man is a product of causes which had no prevision of the end they were achieving, that his origin, his growth, his hopes and fears, his loves and his beliefs are but the outcome of accidental arrangements of atoms. That nothing can preserve an individual life beyond the grave. That all the noonday brightness of human genius is destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system, and that man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins, all these things are so nearly certain that no philosophy which rejects them can hope to stand. It remains only to be proudly defiant of the irresistible forces that tolerate for a moment our knowledge despite the trampling march of unconscious power." A cheerful picture there. Well, what should we make of these kinds of objections now that we've got the categories before us? Well, let's think first a little bit about the irrelevance claim. Why irrelevance? Why should we think that science has made religious belief irrelevant? The basic idea underlying that claim is that science and religion are seen as competing for the same turf. Religion is just an early primitive attempt to answer deep questions on this view, but now science is learning to answer those questions. So scientific answers can replace and supersede the older primitive religious answers. Now, underlying this view is often a form of what's known as scientism. Scientism, as I interpret it, has two basic principles. One is that science is the only legitimate source of belief, the only legitimate approach to truth. Richard Lewontin again, the Harvard biologist. The problem is to get people to reject irrational and supernatural explanations of the world and to accept science as the only begetter of truth. So science is the only way we have to get to truth, but fortunately for us, science is competent to all reality, and it can lead us into all truth. The Marxist crystallographer J.D. Bernal Science by itself is able to provide mankind with a way of life which is first of all self-consistent and harmonious, and secondly free for the exercise of that objective reason on which our material progress depends. So far as I can see, the scientific attitude of mind is the only one which is, at the present day, adequate in both these respects. And notice here that Bernal is saying that science is all-encompassing. It provides us not just with information about the natural world, it can provide us with a way of life. Well, what should we make of this scientism that ultimately underlies a variety of objections? Well, the first thing to see is that with this second principle, science is competent for all reality, it certainly hasn't let us into all truth yet. So what this represents is a prediction, a faith commitment about the power of science in the future. What about the first principle? Well, we saw earlier that science cannot provide the rational justification for its own presuppositions. So if science itself is rationally legitimate, this first principle of scientism has to be false. So what we have here underlying this objection, when we track it down to its lair ultimately, is a faith commitment to the future power of science and a claim about rational justification which is demonstrably false. But some people will say in response, well, okay, maybe science isn't the only source of rational belief, but it's better than anything else we've gotten. It's certainly better than religious belief. Why? The usual answer is because if you look at the source and springs of religious belief, you find that they are not legitimate. So this objection in slightly modified form comes to this. The claim that religious belief arises from specified types of causes, like, for instance, fear, and that beliefs arising from that source are illegitimate or unreliable. They simply aren't aimed at truth, ultimately. A good example of this is, say, Freud and some of his latter-day followers. Freud said that religious belief is a form of wish fulfillment. It's based on deep psychological fears. We are terrorized by life. We are petrified by the thought of death. So we embrace religion for comfort and reassurance. And that's what it's aimed at, comfort and reassurance. It's not aimed at recognizing the cold, hard truth. Well, making good on that challenge requires doing a number of things, including showing that the alleged source of religious belief really is where it comes from. And that's not trivial to do. And as a matter of fact, Freud was spectacularly unsuccessful in that. Those of you who have read some of Freud's work on religion will remember that Freud, in trying to account for the source of a variety of religious and ethical principles, said, well, there was this prehistoric family, and the father of the family was a real brute, and he repressed all of his sons and kept all the best food and all the best women for himself. Finally, the sons got sick of it, so they banded together for conspiracy, killed the old man, and to finish things off in style, ate him. And then afterwards, they got to feeling remorse about what they had done, and so out of remorse, they started applying his rules to themselves even more harshly than he had. Well, you want to ask at this point, now how did Freud know this about this prehistoric case of cannibalism and remorse? I mean, remorse doesn't fossilize very well. The short answer to how Freud knew that was he was making it up as he went along. So here again, once you track things down to their lair, there's much less there than initially appears. There are a couple other points worth noting here, too. It might be true that there are some people that have come to religious belief because of fear. But it might equally be true that there are some people who have rejected religious belief because of fear. Fear of eternal accountability, or perhaps an inability to deal with the idea that something is infinitely superior to them, or perhaps an inability to cope with the insult of being merely a dependent being. And if we track down the idea that sources of belief not aimed at truth are problematic, we run into some difficulties for at least a large segment of not only atheists, but critics of religion. If science says, as say Russell told us, that all of our beliefs are just random accidents of molecular arrangements, then science says that even our scientific beliefs are just random accidents of molecular arrangements. And that raises a rather urgent question. Well, why should we think any of them are true, including our scientific beliefs? J.B.S. Haldane, a very important 20th century biologist, was for a while a Marxist and then gave that up. And he said, I am not myself now a materialist, because if materialism is true, it seems to me that we cannot know that it is true. If my opinions are the result of chemical processes going on in my brain, they are determined by the laws of chemistry, not those of logic. And this is a nastier problem, I think, than a lot of critics of religion realize. Most such critics accept not only a naturalistic, but a specifically Darwinian view of the origin, history, and nature of human beings. And according to Darwin, of course, natural selection operating on a variety of random variations was what produced our faculties, including our cognitive faculties, which are responsible for our beliefs, including our scientific beliefs. But of course, natural selection is aimed not at truth, it's aimed at reproductive success and fitness. That's why the contemporary Darwinist neurophysiologist, and she's a very convinced Darwinist, Patricia Churchland, in a recent article, said there's a fatal tendency to think of the brain as a device whose primary function is to acquire propositional knowledge. From a biological perspective, however, this does not make much sense. Looked at from an evolutionary point of view, the principal chore of nervous systems is to get the body parts where they should be in order that the organism may survive. Improvements in sensory motor control confer an evolutionary advantage. A fancier style of representing is advantageous so long as it's geared to the organism's way of life and enhances the organism's chances of survival. Now catch this. Truth, whatever that is, definitely takes the hindmost. And interestingly enough, Darwin himself more than once expressed similar worries in his private correspondence. Here is just one example. He said, with me, the horrid doubt always arises whether the convictions of man's mind, which has been developed from the mind of the lower animals, are of any value or at all trustworthy. Would anyone trust in the convictions of a monkey's mind, if there are any convictions in such a mind? And notice, incidentally, the date on this letter, 1881. This was a year before, long after he had published The Origin. So the upshot here is that if the claim is that science generates or produces a picture which destroys religious belief, the way Dawkins and others have argued, that very same picture may very well undercut not only religious belief, but the very science that allegedly produced the picture that was supposed to undercut religious belief. That, it seems to me, is what many critics of religious belief have apparently run into without realizing that they have shot themselves in both feet and probably some other parts as well. Now, earlier, to go back to the second subcategory, the track record of religious belief figured in one of the objections. What do track records really mean here? Well, again, Whitehead, an earlier quote, you know, talked about a continuous repetition of an undignified retreat. Well, religion has changed positions over the centuries, but why is that a problem? Science has changed its positions frequently as well, but that's seen as progress. Why this different take on changing positions? A retreat, a humiliation in the case of religion, progress in the case of science. The intuition ultimately, I think, has to do with the role of revelation in Christian belief and in religious belief. If revelation is real and if it's legitimate, then religious believers shouldn't have to change on this view. They shouldn't have been wrong to begin with. So what we see here is really a picture of science portrayed as chipping away at the revelational foundation of religious belief. Well, what should we make of that? First of all, it's worth noting that there isn't any rule that says if Scripture is inspired, we would automatically know how to read it. We might have to learn how to read it, and it's at least possible that we might have to learn how to read it in part through nature itself, and in part even through science itself. Now, for the next few minutes, I want to do a little bit of theological speculation here, and I hope you'll let me get away with this. If we look in Exodus 33, Moses asks God to show him his glory, and God does, although only from the back, but Moses sees it. Now, move to Psalm 19. The heavens declare what? They declare God's glory. So nature, in the form of the heavens, tells us, declares to us, some of exactly the same things, God's glory, that seeing God, as Moses did, would tell us. So nature here is pictured as revealing to us some of the same things about God that God revealing himself directly to us would tell us. And the Psalms passage, Psalm 19 passage continues that day after day they pour forth speech. Now that's interesting. Speech is what? Well, words, for instance. And there may be a connection here to a very central idea of Scripture, the Word of God, the Word made flesh, in the beginning the Word. So it may be, and I said this was speculation, right? It may be that what nature tells us may even be partly in something like the same terms, speech, in which some revelation comes to us. Now, if that's true, it shouldn't necessarily surprise us if it turns out that how we read the words of Scripture, we might have to learn in part from the creation itself. The earth moves. I mean, Christians, along with everybody else, learned that from science. And in the process, Christians learned that there were some things in Scripture that weren't exactly literal descriptions, that were meant to be taken in some other way. Let me give you just an analogy here from involving a friend of mine. This friend has an undergraduate degree in physics, and then he went on and got a PhD in philosophy of science and has done extensive work in the history of science. And a while back he was working on some stuff in Faraday and was reading some Faraday, and he came across a passage that he just could not figure out what Faraday was trying to express. It wasn't a problem with how to interpret it. It wasn't that, well, there are three different ways of reading this sentence in Faraday and I don't know what he meant. Or it wasn't that, well, Faraday is clearly saying this and I don't know why he says that because he's just wrong. He just could not get a grip on the picture that Faraday was trying to express. So he consulted a physics professor, friend of his, who had a specialty in the relevant area. And the physics professor read the passage and couldn't figure out what Faraday was trying to say either. So finally, out of sheer desperation, my friend actually reconstructed the apparatus that Faraday had been using. And for a philosopher to go looking for empirical data is a deep humiliation, but there just wasn't any way around it. And he built the thing, set it going, and then, he says, it became absolutely clear to him what Faraday had meant by his words. He said it just clicked in. In fact, he said he could now see why Faraday had picked some of the specific terms that he had. But in this case, the only way to see what Faraday had meant by his words was to look at what Faraday had done, Faraday's work. He could only think Faraday's thoughts after him by doing Faraday's work after him. And maybe something like that applies to Scripture as well. It might be that in some cases we can only understand what God means by his words by looking at what God has done, by looking at God's works. In that case, the sort of changes that Christians have made historically in various of their beliefs isn't a retreat, but it's progress, and in many cases, progress in step with science itself. So the contrast that we get from people like Whitehead of the triumph of science and its changes as opposed to the humiliation of religious belief and its changes, that contrast just doesn't really stand up too well to scrutiny. All right, finally, I would like to issue some cautionary notes about Kant in general. Now, again, some people argue that science and religion operate in different domains. Stephen Jay Gould, for instance, the late Stephen Jay Gould held this view. And if they do operate in different domains, then science and religion can't come into conflict if both are properly pursued. And if they can't come into conflict, then science couldn't refute, couldn't erode religious belief. And that would mean that people who are trying to destroy religion by appeal to science are just out of luck. People like Richard Dawkins, people like Francis Crick. But suppose that there is a conflict. What would that conflict establish, the fact of that conflict? Well, it would automatically destroy religious belief if science took precedence over religious belief. And that's going to be a general principle that will be difficult to establish, again, at least in the general case. And let me just give you three reasons why establishing that would be difficult. First, there simply is no such thing as rigorous proof in science. The very logic and structure of science itself precludes that. That's why we're often reminded that science is tentative, that it's not dogmatic. That's why we're often told that the scientific attitude is to be prepared to give up a theory if the data start to go in a different direction. So it's always at least possible, in cases of conflict, that it's the scientists who have gotten things wrong. And as a matter of fact, there are some intriguing historical cases of that sort of thing. Second, science is done by human beings. And we human beings have a variety of fairly serious limitations. And the science that we do, to some extent, reflects those limitations. Science of necessity is limited to reasonings that we can do, concepts that we can think, observations that we can make, measurements that we can perform. Now, we can extend our capabilities by means of instruments and computers and things of that sort. But still, any place that science is going to get, it's got to get there from us. The anchors of human science must be in us because human faculties and human capabilities are all we've got. We've got no alternative but to trust some inescapably finite human capacities and insights. Now, you might say, well, yeah, but science tests its theory against nature, and so nature gets the final say. Well, there is certainly something to that, but even in that context, we still have to rely on human convictions about what constitutes a test, human convictions about what constitutes passing a test, human convictions about what constitutes evidence, human convictions about the proper evaluation of evidence and results. And again, that raises Darwin's question. How far can we trust the convictions of a mind if it's simply the accidentally modified version of a lower primate mind? Or Russell's question comes up again. How far can we trust human convictions if they're simply accidental arrangements of molecules? Inevitably, science has human fingerprints all over it, and we humans are limited. Now, does that nullify science? Does it destroy it? Does it undercut it? No, I don't think it does any of those things. But it does impose some cautions. It does impose some limits on what we can claim for it. And then third, there are what I call the fuzzy implications of conflict. The implications of inconsistency and conflict are not always clear even within science itself. First of all, there are lots of cases of what we call theory-data conflict. Nearly every scientific theory in history that has ever been proposed has faced problematic data from its instant of birth, and in many cases, problematic bits of data have been known by the very person proposing the theory at the time they proposed it. That's why one prominent historian of science a while back said that every theory is born refuted. But science cannot function without theories. Theories are absolutely central and crucial to science. So if we tossed every theory that ran into a theory-data conflict, we would kill science very quickly. So science and we must sometimes simply resolve to live with conflict, at least in the short run. We see a similar sort of thing in connection with theory-theory conflict. Many people think that the two best scientific theories that we humans have are relativity theory and quantum mechanics. But it's been known for the better part of a century that those two theories are mathematically inconsistent with each other. But scientists have quite properly refused absolutely to junk either theory and have chosen instead to live that conflict and hope that sometime in the future it can be resolved. So here again, even in science, we often must simply live with conflict for at least a short run and sometimes a bit of a longer run as well. So conflict, even within science conflict we might call it, isn't automatic grounds for pitching something. And it may turn out that science-religion conflicts aren't automatic grounds for pitching anything either, and specifically not grounds for pitching religion. We might there too in some cases, have to simply live with a little bit of tension. So the bottom line here is that logical ambiguity, conflict, are where we flesh and blood humans often live in a lot of different aspects of our life, and we might have to learn to live with that in science and science-religion relations as well. So where does that leave us? Well, I think we can't deny that there are, that there have been, that there may continue to be tensions between science and religion for religious believers. But the case that science demolishes religious belief isn't as easy to make as some people think. I mean, first, as we have seen, many of the arguments that are given that are directed against religion in this conflict, this alleged conflict, simply don't survive scrutiny. But there's something deeper here, I think, as well. Science can only work in a certain sort of reality. And again, as I mentioned earlier, the picture of a comprehensible, intelligible, uniform, predictable, beautiful cosmos, which can in principle make sense to finite minds like ours, that's a picture of a cosmos structured in some very fundamental ways like a mind would do it. That's a cosmos structured like a creation. And third, key presuppositions of science rose out of the doctrine of creation. And there are some historians who have argued that science owes its very existence to religion. And finally, it may be that if we have any hope of getting things right, even in science, that hope must be that our beliefs are not just accidents among molecules, but that we were intended to know, that we were designed to know. And that's a view that perhaps can only come out of a doctrine of creation. Recall again Paul Davies, who is not a Christian or a traditional believer at all, who said, "Science began as an outgrowth of theology, and all scientists, whether atheists or theists, accept an essentially theological worldview. We have to have a theologically shaped picture of the world in order to do science at all." So to adopt a familiar line that all of you have heard, no doubt from Mark Twain, reports of the death of religion at the hands of science appear to be greatly exaggerated. Thank you. I was trying to speed things up a little bit because we've been told we have to be out of this room at 5:30. And it's not that I really want to answer any sneaky and tricky questions, but I thought you should at least have the chance to take a shot at me.
The whole question of was the birth of science really the death of religion, it seems to me like the death of religion needs to be sort of clearly defined. Because if we think of the death of religion as far as 10 people sort of, for one, believing, having religious beliefs, even in academic school, having religious beliefs, as you point out, that seems to be, I think, rather uncontroversial. But I think maybe, for me, the pointed issue is whether religious beliefs or the theological notions have the epistemic privilege or authority that scientific theories and mathematical theories have, for instance. And that seems to be a more tricky question. So if we ask the question, is the birth of science really the death of religion as a sort of authority, an epistemic authority, that seems to be a more troubling or difficult question to answer in favor of traditional religious or theological.
Yeah, and I certainly wasn't addressing the question of whether or not it's still humanly possible in an age of science to hang on to religious beliefs. I mean, people can hang on to all kinds of things, some of them that they obviously shouldn't. It was a question of whether you could rationally, defensibly hang on to such beliefs. But as far as the question of whether or not it still has the same epistemic authority of science, there's been some very interesting work done in the last few years by a number of philosophers that perhaps some of you are familiar with, people like Alvin Plantinga, Nicholas Waltersdorf, and a number of other primarily Christian philosophers, looking at some of the work of Thomas Reid earlier of the Scottish Common Sense School to try to get a firmer grip on just what it means to say that something is rationally acceptable, what the foundations of rational belief are. And it turns out if you look into some of the things that they have looked into, It's not clear that there is any fundamental difference between the foundations, the rational credentials of the foundations of scientific belief and the rational credentials of the foundation of religious belief. As they want to argue, both kinds of beliefs and other beliefs as well arise in us not on the basis of any kind of argument, inference, or anything of the sort, but they are beliefs that ultimately arise in us simply because of the way we are structured in the kind of cosmos that we happen to inhabit. Simple example, all of us think that there's a podium here, presumably, but it's not because any of us have an argument to its existence. It's not because any of us made a decision about whether or not we would believe this podium here. We simply don't have any choice in it. We can't not believe, under our present circumstances, that there's a podium here. And that, according to Reed and his contemporary followers, is really the fundamental sort of belief acquisition. And that underlies not only fundamental principles that science rests on, but, as they see it, fundamental principles that religious belief rests on, too. And that ties in with a variety of things that John Calvin claimed. I have to work him in here someplace. That at some point, all of us are confronted by God, know who it is that we are being confronted by, and know that we have a choice to make as to whether we will respond obediently and rebelliously, but that God's existence and his character comes to us not on the basis of any kind of rational argumentation, but simply in the same way that our belief in the minds of those around us come to us. We simply find that we have that conviction because of the kind of creatures we are. Now, do we have any grounds for trusting the kind of convictions that we creatures have? Well, it's here that theists, at least, have a bit of an advantage, because if we are created as knowing beings, then we would expect that the deep structures and contours of our belief formation capacities were designed to know, and consequently, if we used them correctly, according to the right principles of rationality and so forth, that their deliverances could be, would be, rationally justified. So the whole idea of the foundations of science having more rational authoritativeness and a firmer, say, firmer basis than the grounds for religious beliefs, there are quite a number of at least contemporary Christian epistemologists who would say we've got to look at that a little bit more deeply, and it might not be that way at all. Was that way more than you wanted to hear?
But, I mean, what would, maybe this is too much big of a question, but I mean, what would the rational justification be for theological beliefs or for religious beliefs? I mean, wouldn't that just be equally sort of problematic? I mean, if we're talking about rational justification between science and theology, they'll both have, it seems to me, from a philosophical perspective, a lot of presuppositions, a lot of problems, and a lot of tricky issues to deal with. I mean, what if we just write about rational justification and agree that science and theology sort of live on the basis of faith, whether you're a scientist or not, they're irrespective of the rational justification. Mm-hmm. It seems like now, like growing up in this new millennium, it seems to me that scientific and mathematical sort of inferences and theories and proofs have a lot more epistemic privilege and authority than religious ones on the space when it comes to the nature of reality or the nature of the
answer. Yeah, the question is whether or not they should.
Right.
If you're just pointing to the sociological fact that they do, then we have to start taking seriously some things that I think are really off the wall, that have a lot of cachet in present Western society. But the question that I wanted to address was the rational question, whether or not science has a status that allows it to destroy the rational legitimacy of religious belief, and whether or not culturally the tilt is one way or another, I think is a very separate question from that, and wasn't one that I meant to be addressing. But you know, your suggestion, well, might they just sort of be on the same par? They've all got problems, weaknesses, difficulties, and so forth. Suppose one did take that view. Well, then again, I think you would have to come to the conclusion that there wasn't any good reason to think that science could undercut religious belief if they were on a par in that sense. I mean, if they both have similarly infirm foundations, then there again, you don't have a case from one against the other. And you are looking horribly displeased with all of that. I'm not totally sure that I've quite got a handle on where you're trying to go. But if you push reason, does reason collapse? Does it turn itself on its head and collapse? I'm not exactly sure how to pursue that, although there have been some very intriguing stuff coming out of neurophysiological research concerning how our reason and our specifically our formal reasoning, our logic, actually works. And it turns out that there are things beyond what we have traditionally thought of as rationality and reason that function in the way our cognition in areas that we think of as reason actually works. You can find some of this in recent work by people like V.S. Ramachandran and a number of his colleagues, and then a very recent book entitled How We Think addresses some related issues. And it turns out that, speaking of inverted, that what we think of as simplicity and reason turns out to be the result of some incredibly complicated things that go on underground in our cognition. And exactly where all that's ultimately going to get to go and what the upshot of it's going to be, I'm not really sure. That's a long-winded way of saying that's a tough question and I don't know exactly how to answer it.
You mentioned a few times in your talk that there's one way of thinking that religion and science should be in separate domains.
Yeah.
And they're answering different questions and have different problems to face.
Mm-hmm.
But you didn't really talk about that too much. I was wondering, obviously, if that was the case or if you believe that, there wouldn't be a talk right now. So I'd like to hear from you why you believe what the overlap between those two domains are.
I think the overlap, there's certainly an overlap, I think, at the foundational level. And I think that there are at least some intriguing things coming out of research in some areas like cosmic fine-tuning and some things of that sort that make me think that there might be some places where we're going to see at least some what has sometimes been called interdigitation, if not actual overlap. But I think, too, that that value has an empirical component to it. That's a bit controversial, but I am increasingly coming to think that that might be true. And if it does, then it would turn out that empirical investigation would have some connections to things that have normally been put in the area of value, in the area of religious belief. And again, if you look at the way cognition actually works, it turns out that values function very deeply in a lot of things that we think of as more empirical areas, and even function when it comes to questions of theory evaluation and theory selection. There's a lot of discussion, has been over about the last 10 years, and what are sometimes referred to as epistemic values. And so I think the old idea that we can cleanly separate areas of thought, cleanly separate categories, I think that just doesn't hold up anymore, and I think it's increasingly in a state of collapse. And it certainly isn't the way that our cognitive systems work. Value systems function, or value systems, emotion systems, a variety of subsystems like that function even in what we used to think was just simply straightforward Aristotelian logic. and to try to separate those things sort of when they come to the surface of our cognition and say, okay, we can put science here, we can put religion here, we can have a gulf between them and never the twain shall meet. Even if you can make that look sensible on the surface level, and again with cosmic fine-tuning I think it's increasingly difficult, even if you can make them look separate on the surface level, once you get about a quarter of an inch under the surface of our cognition and find out the way brains actually work, you find out that everything is almost completely interconnected, to the extent that even your emotional reaction to a subject of an Aristotelian syllogism will determine in part what parts of your brain actually function to evaluate the logic of that syllogism, which Aristotle would have rolled over in his grave if anybody had suggested such a thing. Yeah, well, I don't think that faith separates science in any straightforward way from religion. I think there's faith at bottom of both. But if you do take science as just simply limiting itself to apprehendable or empirically apprehendable answers, that's perfectly okay as long as when you get to the end of the process you realize what you've done. But what unfortunately frequently happens, and you see this in a lot of science popularizers, what happens is that you start up front with the limitation on what's going to count as a scientific answer, what's going to count as a scientific pursuit. This is the sort of thing that Richard Lewontin was talking about early on. Then when you get to the end of the process, you forget that you have placed that limitation on, and you take whatever you come up with as simply being a representative of the way reality really is. And if you have that restriction on at the outset, you have to remember what that restriction, the consequences of that restriction and the effects it might have had on what comes out the other end. And if you do that, then that's perfectly fine. But then you have lost the reason for thinking that what you have come up with really does represent the way things really are. It may or it may not. And it seems to me that people like Dawkins, Peter Atkins, Francis Crick, you know, there's a whole roster of people that have simply forgotten that fact and think that what they have done is having undercut the rational legitimacy of religious belief, to the point that people like Dan Dennett have sometimes argued that what we really should do is put religious believers, we should not allow religious believers to raise their own children, and hopefully in the future when we are more enlightened, there may be a few Baptists left, but they will be in zoos where other people can come and see. I don't mean to say that one is presupposing, certainly in any explicit sense, an intelligent creator, but one to do science has to approach reality, whether consciously or not, as if. I mean, the kind of reality that science requires to function is the kind of reality that fits in very nicely with the idea of an intelligent creator. So you don't have to start with that explicit assumption. And a lot of people will say, well, that's just sort of a brute fact that we start with. And where believers have an advantage there is being able to say, well, I don't have to take that as just brute, unexplained fact. I can give you a reason why. I can give you a systematic explanation for why these presuppositions hold together. And so in that sense, I don't think that the intelligent design movement is arguing in any kind of recognizable circle. I don't think that they have made out their particular case, although I don't think that there are any reasons in principle why the kind of case they would like to make can't be made out. I don't think that they are violating any defensible norms of science or anything of that sort. But I don't think that there is an inescapable circularity there. And it wouldn't be surprising if a nature that did allow science to be done supported implications from various aspects of reality, implications of design. That wouldn't be surprising. I, again, am not at all sure that that the advocates of design have managed to really hammer that case down. But I don't see anything in principle impossible about it, or nefarious or underhanded in the attempt.
The way I view it, comparing evolution and intelligent design,
it's sort of like comparing apples and oranges. I mean, even with all our phylogenetics, even if we can strain it down to a common ancestor, evolution does not say that a universal creator did not create that one ancestor. Then that's where Christianity and actual religious belief differ. I'm a biologist, and as a biologist, I would fight against in the Bible where God created Adam and Eve. Yet I would not fight against intelligence science.
Interesting when you said that evolution doesn't say that that first ancestor or something wasn't created. In the last paragraph of early editions of The Origin, Darwin himself, in that famous passage about there's a grandeur in this view of life, suggested that God perhaps breathed life into a few, one or a few, initial forms from which everything else developed. Now, he regretted later having said that. And there's some suspicion that he said that in part maybe to, out of consideration for family members and things of that sort. But he did, in fact, say that in early editions of The Origins, but he later referred to it as truckling. So he, at least, at some points, would agree with you on that.
As a theist, and I'm even a Christian, it's uncomfortable for me to play the part of devil's advocate here. But I've never really accepted this conflict between science and religion. For me, it's not difficult to assert the notion that God created the universe and all the laws of nature and mathematics that have allowed it to evolve to its current state, and that evolution is still ongoing. I agree that perhaps there was that science has some of its origins in theology, but I'm not sure that it was so much an abstract theological dispute as it was certain historical processes or historical events rather that occurred in Western Europe back in medieval times, like the invasion of the Mongols and the incursion right up to the Danube River, the plagues and various diseases that occurred, the problem with the calendar, and the fact that the Pope had to remove several days from October in 1584, and so on.
That happened several times, actually.
Average people came to depend on these things. They felt that they had a contract with the Church, that as long as they believed in the Church and supported the Church financially and so on, these things wouldn't happen. They'd be protected from disease, protected from invaders, and be able to depend on the calendar. But that wasn't happening. And when science comes along with its predictive powers, a demonstrative predictive powers like a more sophisticated understanding of disease would help prevent infection, developing weaponry that would repel invaders, a more sophisticated understanding of astronomy would protect the integrity of the calendar, and so on and so forth. It's easy to understand how people could move towards that belief system and create some sort of conflict. But I think that was more undermining churchianity than it was Christianity. That's the point I wanted to make.
Yeah. And I think there's many responses. I mean, you said a whole bunch of stuff there, and there's a lot of it that I think is right and that I agree with. And the foundations, there were a lot of things that went into that other than just theology, and the acceptance and subsequent appearance of conflict. There was a lot of that, a lot of things there besides just theology. And I think you're right that what was going on with the institutional church and what was going on in broader society played huge roles in a lot of things. But there still, I think, it can be legitimate cases where it looks awfully like there is conflict at levels that go beyond just conflicts of science and churchianity, so to speak. We humans, we have our own slants on things, and often our slants are incomplete enough that things that we think ultimately aren't in conflict certainly look like it. We don't know how to put things together. I mean, even in theology, You know, most Christians confess both that God is in control of things, but that we have free will. That God has foreknowledge, that we have free will. That God approaches us with mercy, but that God also approaches us with justice. I don't know that we know how to put any of those things together, so we've got some conflicts there trying to get the formalisms correct, but ultimately, ultimately there is some way of working those things out, which we might not ever find out in this life. And I think that with our approaches to nature and our approaches more directly to God through religion, that we can often run into the same kinds of things, that there are things where we're doing our honest best in both, and we come against some kind of tensions and we don't know how to deal with them. And so I think there could be deeper things there than just science and the institutional church or churchianity or things of that sort. But again, an awful lot of what you said there I think is absolutely right.